This is The Agenda. Local newsmakers, community leaders, and people in our valley making a difference. Here's your host, Dave Bernstein.
Well, joining us on The Agenda today, we welcome State Senator Brad Hawkins. Schedules kind of conflicted yesterday, but we appreciate getting some time for us today. It's a busy time, and you never quite know how the schedules are going to work out. What point are we at technically, Senator? And again, welcome to the program. But what point are we technically at right now with the session in Olympia?
Well, thanks, Dave, for having me. It's always good to be with you. It's a very busy point in the session for Olympia. We're final phase. I'd say we're probably on the 20-yard line, so we're just getting inside the red zone here, so to speak. We are pushing towards the April 25th adjournment date, which is the scheduled 105th day of the 105-day session. We're pushing hard to get the budgets done, and then also some of us as members have our individual bills that are still alive. I have a few of those. And then some of the major pieces of legislation are still sort of hovering around in these final days as we make this push towards finalizing the budgets.
Well, we'll talk about the budgets here in just a second, since we've got some timely news that because of the Derek Chauvin trial that's kind of dominating some of the news coverage, there is a police tactics bill that I think was passed in Olympia just the other day.
Yeah, this was passed just last night off the state Senate. It's House Bill 1054 related to use of police tactics and equipment by law enforcement officers. It was hotly debated over in the state House. It passed over here. And we had a very long debate last night in the state Senate, multiple amendments. And as you can imagine, there's emotions on all sides of this issue. But sometimes in legislators' efforts to be reactive to certain things, we can overcompensate and have unintended consequences as well, and that's obviously a big concern of mine with this bill. I ended up voting against it because ultimately I really want to make sure that we're protecting the people who are trying to protect us, the people who are on the front lines, our law enforcement officials, providing a very, very important service. But this particular bill would prohibit certain chokeholds and blood chokes, neck restraints. It also would require the Criminal Justice Training Commission to convene certain groups related to model policies. At one point, you know, there's prohibition on canine dogs and tear gas, even non-lethal options. They're taking a lot of those options off the table. And one particular provision that was very concerning to our law enforcement officials in Wenatchee and Chelan County was related to prohibiting the use of certain military equipment that was purchased either from military sources or whatnot, which is what we use. Both the city of Wenatchee and Chelan County has that available for their SWAT teams. And we, as City of Wenatchee and Chelan County, as I've had discussions with Steve Crown and with Sheriff Burnett about this, they do have some of that equipment, and it's multi-million dollar investments in this equipment, certain mine-resistant equipment, very important equipment to us, and other law enforcement agencies across the state have invested in this type of equipment as well, and this bill would have prohibited that. But I worked with colleague of mine from Northwest Washington, whose law enforcement agencies were also affected, like City of Wenatchee and Chelan County. And then we worked with the Democratic lead from Seattle on this bill, and they were fortunately willing to accept that amendment. And so now the law enforcement equipment that we have isn't prohibited under this bill, but there are a lot of troubling steps taken to reform police tactics with this legislation. I do anticipate Governor Inslee will sign the bill.
All right, let's talk about the budgets now. Democrats have, I believe, proposed $59.2 billion in their operating budget. It does include a 7% capital gains tax above $250,000. So that that is a huge increase in our operating budget proposal coming out of the Senate Democrats.
Yeah, and a huge huge proposal proposed by House Democrats as well, basically blowing the lid off this budget. If we look back just a few years, maybe 10 years to when I first got elected to the legislature, the state budget was approximately $31 billion. And this proposal is proposing upwards of $60 billion. 59 and a half or wherever it might end up. But it's very troubling with all of the spending that is being proposed. I do not believe this will be sustainable for our state. Basically, the proposal that Senate Democrats not only proposed, but they passed out of the Senate, and I voted against it, would assume use of all the extra revenue from this most recent very positive state revenue forecast. It assumes that capital gains income tax will become law, as you mentioned and as we've discussed before, and it also fully utilizes our budget stabilization account, which is known as our rainy day fund, which had a $2 billion reserve, which initially going into this session I could have supported using, but with all of this extra revenue growth and things turning out much less bad than previously anticipated with the COVID pandemic, I didn't feel the need to either spend all of the new revenues that we're projected to receive over the next 2 and 4 years and also fully drain our reserve account, and then certainly no need for a new tax like the capital gains. So the Senate budget proposal is passed. The House, I believe, has passed their proposal too. And like the other two budgets, the operating budget leads will get together over the next couple weeks in a series of meetings and try to iron out the differences in the budget. And they'll work with the governor's office too, because in the end, for all three budgets, the House and the Senate and the governor need to all agree on one document in its exact same form. So that's what they'll be working to do over the next couple weeks.
Seattle Times reported that the new budget gives new aid for businesses, child care programs, funds a tax exemption for low-income families. With the revenues that we already had coming in, could we have done it without such a large increase in the proposal?
I think we could have done some of those things, although some of the other things are much more expensive. So, for example, the child care benefit is something that Senate Democrats and House Democrats have really been promoting. We currently have a system where if people receive state support for their child care, they also have to pay a copay, and that's something people are pretty familiar with. Well, currently, if someone earns approximately 50% or half of what we know as the state median income, their child care monthly copay is about $500. Yes, that's expensive. We all understand the importance of child care and the importance of access to child care. But the question is really who pays? Under this current proposal, which cost $1 billion, by the way, it would reduce the copay, for example, in the child care program from $500 a month to approximately $115 a month for a family with that same median income. And on one hand, you might say, well, that's great for those families to have it so much more affordable, but the reality is, who pays? And I think what the Senate Democrats and House Democrats are basically saying is we both agree that child care is expensive, access to child care is important, but the Senate Democrats are basically saying instead of the people using the child care programs paying, everybody else should have to pay for your child care. And that those are the types of things that grow the budget, and those are also the types of things that are going to be very difficult to scale down if we have a dip in revenue 2 years, 4 years, 6 years out. Because what happens is we built this big budget, and we built in some new programs in it, or what's being proposed. And when we do have an economic slowdown, and the state revenue forecast isn't nearly as rosy as what is currently being projected, and we have a legitimate slowdown in the economy, we don't have backfilled dollars from the federal government, who, by the way, Dave, probably borrows the money from China. But when we actually have a slowdown in our revenues, what are we going to do 2 years, 4 years, 6 years out? We're probably going to need to either raise taxes more to make up for it, or we're going to have to scale back some of these programs. Some of these programs that are probably pretty popular at that point, like expanded child care copays and other things. So I just don't feel that this budget overall on balance is doing the responsible thing. I think it spends too much and obviously assumes that capital gains tax, which is risky in and of itself because voters could strike that down in a referendum. The state Supreme Court could not uphold it in court if it's challenged, and that alone creates a huge hole potentially in the budget. So there's a lot of reasons I'm frustrated about this, and obviously I won't be able to support it likely on the final vote either.
And does the $59.2 billion include money from the COVID-19 relief package, or is that money on top of the $59.2 that we would spend? In other words, are we building a budget that includes money that was from an unprecedented COVID relief plan that isn't going to be coming in every 2 years?
It's actually a little bit of both. For the most part, the 59.5 or whatever billion-dollar figure it'll end up to be, or maybe $60 billion by the time it's all said and done, that's what we call the state near-term general fund budget. It actually isn't the entirety of the state budget because the state budget also includes federal dollars normally on an annual biennial basis for Medicaid match and some of the other federal programs. And these federal stimulus dollars are sort of in that other bucket, which isn't really part of this $59 billion that we see. However, back to that child care program, the way the at least the Senate passed budget proposes to fund that is to use the one-time federal dollars to fund a portion of that in the near term and then rely on the capital gains tax to pick up the remaining cost in the out years. So I have another issue with that of using any one-time federal dollars for ongoing activities, you know, recurring expenses, for example. I strongly believe that these one-time federal dollars should be used for one-time stimulus activities. Instead, we're using one-time dollars potentially to build in ongoing programs, which is what we call creating a bow wave effect in the budget, where in the out years the wave comes up and we have a lot of costs that we will be incurring in the out years with this budget, even beyond the $59 billion that we're voting on this year.
Yeah. We'll take a break here. I want to ask about the capital and transportation budgets, also carbon taxes, and also even a Senate bill that we heard that had not even gotten a hearing, but I think it's the Freedom Caucus is trying to push, I think it's Senate Bill 5144 that would say, hey, getting a COVID vaccination is a very personal thing, and that government should not be mandating that. Employers should not be able to force you to get one. And we'll see what you've heard on the prospects of that. We've got Senator Brad Hawkins for the full hour today on the agenda. We'll be back after this.
To hear previous editions of The Agenda, log on to kpq.com and look for shows under the On Air tab. The Agenda will be right back on KPQ or streaming on Alexa and kpq.com. Welcome back to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ with Dave Bernstein.
Well, we're back on The Agenda with State Senator Brad Hawkins joining us. And we want to talk about our capital and transportation budgets as well. I understand that both the House and Senate have unanimously approved their versions of the two-year construction budget, the capital budget. So those have to be, of course, negotiated. So what can you give us an update on the construction or capital budget fronts?
Well, both of those budgets are budgets that I supported. As we talked about in the previous segment, I voted against the operating budget proposal in the Senate, but the transportation budget and the capital budget were both budgets that had broad bipartisan support. The transportation budget this year is approximately $11.7 billion. At least that's what was approved out of the Senate. The revenues in transportation are way down this year due to, you know, very few people actually using the roads during the pandemic, and a lot of the license fees and fuel taxes and other revenues that help fuel the transportation budget just didn't really fully materialize. So it's much more of a slender budget, if you will. But what the transportation budget on a biennial basis does is it funds the State Patrol, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Licensing staff, but it also funds and appropriates dollars for prior approved construction projects that were a part of a bigger revenue package, like what was approved in 2015. So this particular biennium, you know, there are projects being scheduled all throughout the state as part of that transportation budget. Now, one thing that's kind of important to point out, and I can understand why people get confused, that is the two-year transportation budget. That has no gas tax increase or carbon fee or anything associated with it. But in addition to the normal two-year transportation budget, this particular session, there are also a number of new revenue transportation proposals being floated out there, even as recently as just yesterday by the Senate Democratic Chair of the Transportation Committee, Steve Hobbs. And we could talk about that a little bit. I just wanted to point out that those are actually separate, and sometimes people refer to those sort of mistakenly as a transportation budget, but the transportation budget, which I approved, did not include a gas tax increase. And then thirdly, capital budget is, I think, about a $6 billion budget. It normally, as you mentioned, funds infrastructure projects and, you know, higher education facility buildings, also some local projects, and it also includes a matching component, which is what's known as the School Construction Assistance Account, and that is assistance to the schools in matching dollars if they approve their school construction bonds at a 60% threshold. And so we do have a pretty generous matching program for school facilities that voters do when they do approve their bonds. And so that's all part of the capital budget. Representative Steele, who's, of course, my seatmate in the 12th District, is one of the negotiators of the capital budget on the House side. So he and I have been staying in touch on some projects and trying to strategize. So, but hopefully Representative Steele will be meeting over the next couple weeks with other colleagues on the capital budget, and the House and Senate will be able to find a good compromise within the next couple weeks on that, just like I do expect we will on transportation. But like we discussed with operating, I don't think we're going to get there. It's probably going to be a Democrat-only operating budget.
So since you mentioned the capital budget, so does that come, does that, you know, when you're talking about the local projects, does that just kind of come down to a little, I guess I make the analogy of a little card trading? I mean, do the negotiators on that kind of come down to, well, you can get this project in, I'll get that project in, and so at this point, is it a little premature to kind of try and find out what may be on the list locally here in the 12th District to make them the cut, so to speak?
Well, yeah, it's a little of both. You know, asking how the sausage is made is a little difficult to explain, but I can certainly appreciate the interest. You know, the capital budget has a little bit of both. It has these defined programs within the capital budget related to school construction assistance, higher education facilities. Another program will be the Washington Wildlife Recreation Program, which funds parks and trails and land acquisitions. That's a widely supported program. And we have state parks and other areas that get their capital facilities funded in these programs. And what the budget writers have to do is determine at what level of funding to draw the line to fund these programs. But then within those programs themselves, within the capital budget, there are competitive grant programs. There are windows of applications for some of these entities to apply to the state or apply, for example, to the Recreation and Conservation Office with their grant application. And then those programs throughout the whole year go through and score them and actually rank them so that when it comes to the capital budget development, let's say the capital budget decides to fund this particular program at $100 million, then there's a particular list that's associated with that, and we can see how far to draw the line on what projects get funded. Now, those are the individual different programmatic elements of the capital budget, but then there is a section in addition to that that's local and community programs, and that's intended to be for legislators to offer additional ideas for programs and projects that may not have particularly fit one area of the budget. And for example, last time around, 2 years ago, a project that I was focused really diligently on getting funding was the Wenatchee Landing Sewer Extension. And in the end, we were able to secure $4 million for that project in the final budget, which now, as you recall, Dave, that project's now been completed by the Douglas County Sewer District, and Douglas County's been working very closely on that, and the port was involved. So that's a really helpful infrastructure project, just as an example of something that I was able to get funded in the capital budget. But it is sometimes we pursue things that are within these program elements and try to make sure that the funding is sufficient to cover our projects. The others, if it falls into these other categories, that is more of the card trading and political exercise that, you know, legislators are engaged in.
Well, it's our legislative update with State Senator Brad Hawkins. And before we go to our break, let's talk about revenues for the transportation budget and gas taxes or carbon fees. So where are we at with the proposals and negotiations on that? What can you tell us?
Well, it's interesting. You know, at one point, Dave, probably a few weeks ago, I would have said these are dead. You know, the remote session, it doesn't lend itself to putting these big packages together. But there are many transportation advocates that are still working very hard on trying to secure support for a new transportation investment package. And the way this works is there's a corresponding list of revenues that are increased, like the gas tax or a carbon fee and some of these other things. So a corresponding list of revenues and then, or a list of revenues and a corresponding list of projects that would be funded based off those revenues. And if you can gain support for that, then the projects that are associated with that particular package, you know, would be approved. So for example, just yesterday, the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, Steve Hobbs, who I noticed, by the way, just called me while I'm on the phone here with you, is asking for a 16-year, $18 billion package for funding new transportation projects. On the revenue side, for example, it's a $5 billion increase in the gas tax, and I think he accomplishes that with a 9-cent increase in the gas tax. And he also includes a carbon fee component, which would raise another $5 billion. And then also, one of the things that is kind of interesting, which I support is this portion of the package, is that the sales tax on electric vehicles, actually, the sales tax on all vehicles goes to the operating budget okay? The sales tax on vehicles doesn't actually go to the transportation budget. What Chair Hobbs is proposing is, and this would generate $3 billion over his package, is to create, get the electric vehicle sales tax to be transferred to the transportation budget. So that would be very helpful to him.
Well, but then they're gonna just raise another tax to backfill there for the operating budget, I'm afraid. But
yeah, well, it's one of the issues. Actually, I'm frustrated, for example, that the operating budget, that the sales tax on all the vehicles for sales tax goes to the operating budget. I think it should go to the transportation budget for road projects.
Yeah, it should. It should.
I also don't think that the transportation budget should be funding the staff cost of DOT staff, of state patrol staff, and Department of Licensing staff. To me, those are state employees, and all of the other operating costs for state employees are covered with the operating budget. So I would like to see those expenses in the transportation budget transferred to the operating budget to create more capacity for the transportation budget to fund road projects. And frankly, this year, with all the extra revenue, would have been a great year to do something like that. And those are the types of things that some of the Senate Republicans would probably be doing if we still had the majority. Now, I talked a little bit about the revenues. Now, on the expenditure side of this this proposal from yesterday, it does include $225 million for the Apple Capital Loop projects, which are a collection of five projects that include the $130 million Confluence Parkway second bridge across the Wenatchee River, which I know you discussed just yesterday with Mayor Koontz, because I listened to a little bit of your agenda interview. So that is in the Senate transportation proposal. But do the people of our district want to pay 9 cents more per gallon of gas? Do they want a carbon tax associated with that and some of these other things? And the things I've heard from constituents is no, they don't. I know also that the city of Wenatchee and other stakeholders are applying for that federal grant again for the Apple Capital Loop projects. I'm a supporter of that. I hope that's successful. I know they're also looking at the President Biden mega infrastructure project as a potential possibility with Secretary Buttigieg. So, you know, I think the city of Wenatchee has some extra opportunities for that, and hopefully those will be successful, because I am not convinced that this $18 billion of new revenue with this transportation package will actually advance this year. But anything's possible in these last couple weeks.
Well, it's like anything, though, with gas taxes. We get back way more than the gas tax that we pay for the projects that that we do get. So, and everyone will be paying that 9 cents to help pay for our North End improvements. So I guess it is a matter of perspective, because the 9 cents we'd pay would never pay for those improvements on the North End. So I guess there's two ways to skin that cat.
It depends, and that's why I actually like to look at this from a cost-benefit perspective. I like to do the analysis, and we can do that. How much in 9 cents of a gallon would we be, as a 12th district drivers, paying into the system over this, you know, 16 years? And then how much are we getting back in projects? The amount of dollars we're getting in projects is pretty easy to quantify. The more challenging aspect is how much would we be paying in. And in the past, when I did that analysis in 2015, I voted against the prior gas tax proposal that we would not receive a return on our investment. Also, the transportation system is a statewide system. It helps us get our fruit to market and other things. So right. There are a lot of factors in play. But the reality is, Dave, and it's an important conversation, is that if we do want new additional projects, then we need to pay for them. I mean, there's no easy way around that. And we may not like the gas tax, but that is currently how primarily we fund things. But there are other fees too, like this carbon element that's being proposed in yesterday's package.
Well, we'll take a quick break here because we could use up the rest of our time probably just talking about that and what are we going to do when we're driving more fuel efficient or not even fuel consuming vehicles, and what happens to the gas tax then. And but we must take a quick break because I want to get updates on other bills that you've been pushing. And then another one that I asked about that we try and touch on here before the end of the segment. So State Senator Brad Hawkins with us for the full hour on the agenda. And we'll be back after this.
To hear previous editions of the agenda, log on to kpq.com and look for shows under the On Air tab. The agenda will be right back on KPQ or streaming on Alexa and kpq.com. Welcome back to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ with Dave Bernstein.
And the agenda today are legislative updates. State Senator Brad Hawkins with us. And let's ask real quick, because I promised I would, Senate Bill 5144, I understand the Freedom Caucus is in Olympia trying to push this. It didn't get a hearing earlier, but essentially it says that getting a COVID vaccine is a very personal thing. And for those that don't want to get it, they shouldn't be forced to get it. That should be a personal choice. What have you heard about the prospects of this Senate bill?
Yeah, well, I don't anticipate that bill will be advancing. It could just be more of a messaging opportunity to kind of highlight the important personal decision that a COVID vaccine is. And just to be clear, I don't want people to be forced to get a vaccine that they're not comfortable with. If it is something that they want, I do think it's something that can protect them. But the more I've actually looked into it, it's kind of an interesting scenario that plays out. Because, for example, some people have said, hey, I don't support this idea of vaccine passports. And my initial reaction is, of course, I don't support that either. I don't think in order to do certain things, the government should require you to have received this particular vaccination. But then it gets a little more complicated than that. For example, if people want to board an airplane, they say they don't want to be required to show a proof of vaccination to board an airplane. But the airlines are private businesses. And as a Republican, I don't really support extra regulations on private businesses. So most of the time, this isn't actually going to be a state issue when it comes to boarding an airplane. Those are federal regulations, and I'm sure the federal government requirements will apply to them, and there's nothing really the state can do to prohibit or permit one way or another. But for example, if one of the airlines wants to require that, should we step in and try to say they shouldn't be allowed to do that for their business? Because if some airlines want to require that to travel and other airlines don't, then the market can kind of take its course and people can pick the airline that they're most comfortable with. Similarly, for example, when it comes to local governments, generally speaking, I do not support the state of Washington dictating to local governments what they should do. I'm a local control advocate. So, for example, with school districts, should the state of Washington prohibit this statewide, or should we allow local school districts to make that decision based on the locally elected school boards? So, for example, if I was still on the school board, and as you know, Dave, I served as a school board member for Eastmont for a number of years, I would not require the teachers and other school employees to get vaccinated. But what I probably would advocate for if I was a school board member is for every school employee, teachers, administrators, and support staff to have access to the vaccine and to be given an opportunity. But if they do not choose to get vaccinated, I would actually ask them to sign a waiver so that the school district's not liable if they get sick. And that's, you know, it's a personal choice. A lot of people don't want to get vaccinated, and I respect that. And I don't want to force them to get vaccinated either. But also, for example, do I want my tax dollars having to pay their hospital bill also if they spend a week in the hospital with COVID and they could have avoided it with the vaccine. So those are all, you know, really kind of complicated decisions. One business owner, for example, last example, told me, hey, I'm a dentist, and are you saying I can't require my employees to get vaccinated? I'm saying, well, you know, I guess I don't think you should, but if you want to require that, you're in private business, you know, maybe that should be your choice. Because one of the things he wanted to do is he wanted to put signs up, you know, on his dental practice that said, all of my employees are 100% vaccinated. And he felt that that would help his business because people would feel more comfortable receiving their dental treatment if all of their employees, you know, were openly vaccinated, you know, and that was all understood. And so those are kind of complicated decisions. And I'm not sure, back to your original question, that this particular bill sort of, it kind of painted in a pretty broad brush, and I don't think it gets into all those intricacies. But this, there's no doubt that vaccine policy has been a big, big issue in recent years in the state, even before the pandemic. And coming out of the pandemic, it's going to be, I think, a big issue, both in our state and throughout the United States and the world, probably for many years to come.
Well, I want to leave you about 5 minutes here left in the show to give an update on progress on bills you've been sponsoring or co-sponsoring in the session this year.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dave. So one of the bills I've sponsored is Senate Bill 5158 related to utility wildfire, helping to implement the key recommendations from electric utilities DNR work group. And Steve Wright from Chelan PD has been a big supporter of that, as well as a lot of other utilities. And I'm thankful to say that that bill could pass off the House floor today or tomorrow, hopefully this week. So that's one bill. I also have the bill related to providing tow truck operators an opportunity to actually get paid if the drivers were liable and caused an accident and the tow truck operators were stuck with the cost. And fortunately, I'm pleased to say that that bill is potentially positioned to pass the House of Representatives this week as well. My third bill is the hydrogen vehicles bill, Senate Bill 5000, related to providing an equal tax incentive for hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles as what the state has always provided for battery electric vehicles. And that bill also is positioned to pass the legislature, although I think if that does pass, it might come in the final week or so of session, whereas these other two, if they pass, could pass this week.
All right. Well, you could go 3-0.
Yeah, well, 3-4, because I had this other education bill that I guess related to school calendars and pushing, I guess I was pushing the issue a little too much. It was a little too radical of an idea to encourage school districts to reform their school calendars at this point, but it's a topic that did generate a lot of attention statewide. I did get a lot of media requests about it, and I hope to continue to push that issue. But the other three, definitely, I'm very thankful they are where they are.
Okay, well, maybe we can place a wager here. I know that there's a push that the governor will end his emergency powers here before the end of the legislative session, the 105-day session. I'm guessing he won't. What's your bet?
Oh, on the state of emergency or
yeah.
Whatever? Probably not. Actually, when it comes to emergency powers, we actually had some reform bills, one of which I co-sponsored to update the state's Emergency Powers Act so that if the governor did want to declare an emergency, he could do it one time for 30 days or 45 days, but then the second time he'd have to bring the whole legislature back for legislative approval. I don't think that bill is going to make it to the governor's desk either, because I don't think he wants to take action on something like that. But I do think we should be learning a lot from this past year, and we should make some updates and modernizations to some of the laws related to emergency powers, because I don't think it really makes sense to be in emergency for 16 or 18 months, and that might be where the governor's going to take this.
Okay, for people that would like to stay in touch with your legislative assistance, or contact you here during the session, what's the best way to stay in touch?
The best way to stay in touch with me is through my website, which is senatorbradhawkins.org. You can get all my updates on all my recent news, on my email, newsletters, my contact information, our phone number. We do have staff. We're all working remotely, but my office exists to serve the people of the 12th District. We're still receiving many, many emails and phone calls, but fortunately, I think everybody who reaches out to us hopefully gets the answers that they were looking for. So if people have questions or concerns or just generally thoughts about state government, please reach out to me through my website at senatorbradhawkins.org.
Okay, Senator, thanks for joining us today on The Agenda.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dave. Always great to be with you.